It's about 4 o'clock, so we begin. Welcome. I'm John Marty, and this is my second week at Holden, and doing a number of talks on public policy and social justice. Today's, I'm a state senator from Minnesota for a good number of years, and glad to be at Holden to talk about some of these topics and to have discussions, and it gives me new thoughts and so on as we have these talks and discussions. Anyway, today's topic was listed on the board as poverty in a land of plenty, the politics of wealth and poverty. Many working Americans live in cars and homeless shelters. Why can't workers afford basic necessities? This is to look at economic disparities and inability of many hardworking people to earn enough income to pay their bills. With that, we are the wealthiest society on the planet at perhaps the wealthiest time in the planet in human history. Through most of human history, people were lucky to have subsistence level of income. Always small number of people who had more than that, but in medieval times, throughout history, people spent all their waking hours taking care of themselves. We've grown from there in many ways, and not just in our country, but across the planet. We've got some people with untold wealth, incredible ability to get whatever they want and more than they want and more than you can find a way to do with. Yet we have, even in our own country, a growing number of people without health care again. We have lots of people without food, lots of people with inadequate housing. And before going into more specific, first wanted to comment that the global situation, I think in Steve's session the other day was talking about global disparities being reduced in recent years, and they have definitely been. Disparities between nations are going down. The wealthiest nations aren't that much more wealthy than poorer nations in the past. Having said that, the world has a lot of inequality. In last year, they said the richest 1% of the world population took in about 82% of the wealth created that year, and the bottom half got virtually zero. So 1% getting 82% of the new income coming in. Turning to the U.S., the numbers are, in many cases, similar. We may have the society with the greatest disparities. As of last November, the three wealthiest Americans had more wealth than the bottom half of Americans combined. Three individuals, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett. And that's just the top three. I mean, the poorest of those three, Warren Buffett, had $78 billion. Jeff Bezos at the time of that was $81 billion, though a month later, that was the Forbes 400 listing. A month later, Amazon stock went up to the point that Bezos was now, went from $81 to $95 billion in 1 month or a couple months' time, making him now the richest individual. But even if you go beyond those top three, which have as much as the bottom half of the U.S. population, 160-some million people, even if you go beyond them, the next one below the Warren Buffett, $78 billion, is Mark Zuckerberg with $71 billion. So, I mean, it's not like they're three and then everybody else is a lot lower. You go four and you got all of a sudden significantly more. And last month, using the numbers from the Census Bureau, UN Human Rights Commission, they had their reporter on extreme poverty and human rights issued a report on the United States, and was requested by the administration, but they harshly condemned it after it came out. The report said, in a rich country like the U.S., the persistence of extreme poverty is a political choice made by those in power. With political will, it could readily be eliminated. And that report showed 40 million Americans in poverty, one out of every eight. In 2018, the poverty line in the U.S. is about just over $25,000 for a family of four. That doesn't sound like it's hard to calculate what that is, but think of four people trying to find housing, food, and everything else for just over $2,000 a month. And on top of that, half of those 40 million people, about 18 million people, live in what they call extreme poverty, which is half the poverty line. So 18 million Americans are living at less than, for a family of four, it would be about $12,500, $1,000 a month for a family of four. Obviously, for a family individual, it's a lot lower levels than that. One out of every six children in our country lives in poverty. I'm going to just quickly read a couple of statements because the UN, the rapporteur on from the UN report, he commented in several ways that I thought were very insightful about the country. He said the attitude of how things are, well, let me start by quoting. He described what he was seeing, and this was a summary of a tour he did in the U.S. I met many people barely surviving on Skid Row in Los Angeles. I witnessed a San Francisco officer telling a group of homeless people to move on, but having no answer when asked where they could move to. Heard thousands of poor people get minor infraction notices, which seemed to be intentionally designed to quickly explode into unpayable debt, incarceration, and replenishment of municipal coffers. Saw sewage-filled yards in states where governments don't consider sanitation to be their responsibility. I saw people who lost all their teeth because adult dental care is not covered. I heard about soaring death rates and family and community destruction wrought by prescription and other drug addiction. That with people in the south of Puerto Rico living next to a mountain of completely unprotected coal ash, which rains down upon them, bringing illness, disability, and death. He wrote, "Who are the poor?" He said, "I was struck by the extent to which caricatured narratives about purported innate differences between rich and poor have been sold to the electorate by some politicians and media and have been allowed to define the debate. The rich are industrious, entrepreneurial, patriotic, the drivers of economic success. The poor are wasters, losers, and scammers. As a result, money spent on welfare is money down the drain. To complete the picture, we are told poor who want to make it in America can easily do so. They can achieve the American dream if only they work hard enough." Mm-hmm. And I will say that the Trump administration's attacks on this were saying that it was very politically biased and so on, but I do have to say what I hear from constituents, what I hear from some of my colleagues telling constituents, what I hear from some of the media telling them, is very much the poor are lazy, the rich are hardworking, that's the way it is. And the reporter said the reality I've seen is very different. It's the fact that many of the wealthiest citizens do not pay taxes at the rates others do, hoard much of their wealth offshore, often make profits purely from speculation rather than contributing to the overall wealth of the American economy. Who then are the poor? Racist stereotypes are usually not far beneath the surface. Poor are overwhelmingly assumed to be people of color, whether African Americans or Hispanic immigrants. The realities are 8 million more poor whites than blacks. Similarly, large numbers of welfare recipients are assumed to be living high on the hog. And that's when I hear over and over again, these folks are cheating and they're taking, Ronald Reagan had the anecdote about the welfare recipient driving a Cadillac to buy a steak at the grocery store and everything else. That has not changed. Some politicians and political appointees with whom I spoke were completely sold on the narrative of such scammers sitting on comfortable couches watching color TVs while surfing on their smartphones, all paid for by welfare. Mm-hmm. He said, "I wonder how many of these politicians ever visited poor areas, let alone spoken to those who dwell there. Their anecdotes are plenty, but evidence is nowhere to be seen. In every society, there are those who abuse the system, which is true here as well, as much in upper income levels as in the lower. But poor people I've met from among the 40 million living in poverty were overwhelmingly either persons who had been born into poverty or those who had been thrust there by circumstances largely beyond their control. Physical or mental disabilities, divorce, family breakdown, illness, old age, unlivable wages, or discrimination in the job market." We hit the nail on the head as to a lot of what the political attitudes are. A lot of my colleagues know that everybody in poverty is choosing to be there. The fact that somebody's working at a plant that shuts down in a small town and 100 employees who make $20 an hour are laid off and they can try and get a job at the convenience store for $8 an hour, that's kind of, well, they should get a different job. But I thought the UN report, which was very explicit in saying how the U.S. is the most unequal of all countries, again, that it was a sore point with the Trump administration, even though they had encouraged them to conduct this report. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, said it's patently ridiculous for the UN to examine poverty in America. She said the UN Human Rights Council's role is to shine a light on countries where governments cause suffering for their people, suggesting they study Burundi and Democratic Republic of the Congo. And the special rapporteur wasted the UN's time and resources deflecting attention from the world's worst human rights abusers and focusing instead on the wealthiest and freest country in the world. That was a few days after she announced that the U.S. was drawing from the Human Rights Council, the first country to do so. So it was not well received, understandably, but they were saying, she was saying, they ignored all the progress we're making in addressing poverty. But the report and a lot of other evidence suggests that things are actually going the opposite direction. They are getting worse. In the tax cut last year, vast majority of the benefits are going to high-income people, and low-income people are getting less. And given the fact that it was supposed to stimulate the economy, but Congressional Budget Office and everybody else said it's not going to do it that way, which means we either have higher deficits or we cut spending on things like things that might help these folks, it is getting worse. Healthcare, it seems to me, I'm doing a talk on that, I think it's tomorrow, but healthcare, in response to growing costs, which we have double costs, healthcare costs per person of any other country, with not, there are 10 exceptions, but they're way below us. The 10 that get more than half of the expenditures of us, but everyone else spends less than half of us with better outcomes. But the way we respond to that is we're going to make it, employers shift more responsibility to workers, government shifts more responsibility to others. If we put more skin in the game, people will be more cautious about the health care they get. And given the fact that we're pushing costs onto patients, many of whom already can't afford it, we do have a looming crisis coming in healthcare, and it's getting worse in Minnesota, and I would argue most other states as well. One of the ways we deal with that healthcare or other welfare things, which the UN report commented on, was we decide that because the low-income folks are lazy, we should make them work, and we want to encourage them to work. We had a proposal last year, this past spring, to require work in order to receive Medicaid, which for 50 years of Medicaid, there have never been work requirements. That's being pushed at the national level as well. Mm-hmm. But in Minnesota, there was a proposal to do so. I was in the hearing, the first time it was heard in the Senate, and it was like a three-hour hearing, 50 witnesses or so. One person spoke in favor of the proposal. He happened to be from the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity group. He was the only one to speak in favor. We had counties, we had human service folks, we had the medical folks, especially mental health people. We had counties, faith groups, everybody else was testifying how this was a mistake. The authors even acknowledged this wasn't to save money, because it would cost more to administer this. They would have a monthly work requirement. You had to work at least 50% of the time every month or you're cut off, and then it takes several months to get back. And one of the people who testified there, one of the people who's on medical assistance, said he's worked hard all his life. He was a veteran who moved up from Georgia a number of years ago, African-American man who said, you know, I've had many jobs. I've done service industries. None of my jobs ever had health care benefits. None of them ever had sick leave. None of his jobs did. My jobs have always had those things. You see where he is, he said, you know, with some PTSD and so on, he says, I can't always work. He says, I consider myself a very hard worker, but there are some months I can't work. And if he can't work for at least 2 weeks full time in a month and get a job to have that, because when you're unstable in your ability to work, you don't always have a job readily available. If he would go 1 month with less than half-time employment, he's off the program. And with PTSD and other things, it's a sad way of doing it. But we had, at the end of this 2.5-hour hearing, I was thinking, how is anybody going to justify supporting this? Is anybody actually going to vote for this? And of course, the answer was yes. It did pass out of committee and later on died. But why would they do it? Well, politically. Everybody knows these welfare bums are lazy, and so they're trying to get something for nothing, and they said most of the people on Medicaid are already working. Most of them are already working people, just earning very little, and those that aren't are usually not able to work. And the UN report commented on this attitude, which I think is one more quote I want to read from them. Proposals to slash the meager welfare arrangements that currently exist are now sold primarily on the basis of poor need to get off welfare and back to work. The assumption is here that there are a great many jobs out there waiting to be filled by individuals with low educational standards, often suffering from disabilities of one kind or another, sometimes burdened with a criminal record, perhaps for the crime of homelessness or not being able to pay a parking ticket. That's true in some states. And with no training or meaningful assistance to obtain employment. And that's the reality. I mean, we are taking people, the people who testified, the ones who were recipients of it were, many of them, they said, you can't see my disability, it's mental health. And they talk openly in front of an audience about what they're going through. And most of them, their work record is on and off and on and off, depending on their health. And somehow the idea that many of the mental health providers pointed out that we're going to cut these folks off of it and then they're going to work harder. It's not a reality thing, but yet it was being pushed because they know it scores political points, because you have to work hard, you're paying a fortune for your health care, and these guys are getting it for free. And so the situation is not in a good spot, and it seems to be headed in a bad way right now. Even in before the last few years of the way we've been going, there was an article in the Minneapolis paper about 7-8 years ago. The headline to it was, Rochester homeless man decides jail is better than the streets. And it was an intriguing little story, about this long. It was about 4 paragraphs or so. It didn't say much, but it did spell out what you could figure out from it. It was a guy who showed up at the police station in Rochester, Minnesota, a little bit of blood on his hand, and said, I broke some windows in an auto dealer. Arrest me. And so they send somebody out there, and sure enough, there are a couple $1,000 worth of broken windows and cars, and yeah, there's a little blood there, which he said, yeah, you can prove it's me, it's my blood there. They start writing up a citation for him and so on, and he says, arrest me. And they said, well, we don't usually do that for something. I said, if you don't arrest me, I'll go out and break some more windows. And he explained that he'd rather be in jail, because he was homeless, and he get 3 hot meals a day, and you get a warm bed and so on if you're in jail. And I keep thinking, what have we stooped to when we got people who are saying, I'd be better off if they locked me up than being on the street? So that sort of implies some sinking expectations, and I wanted to talk about that for a minute, how low our expectations have fallen. Obviously, you know, at times when we're talking about school funding and other things, you know, we're in a scarce society, we don't have enough for everything. Schools have to, they cut back, they lay off teachers, do everything like that. Certainly extras in Minnesota a few years ago, there was an attempt to cut out arts and music as extra. If the local school district wanted to pay for it, they could pay for it, but that shouldn't be a state obligation, according to one education commissioner. And schools, they obviously can't afford to provide musical instruments and free music lessons to young kids who are considering joining the band and so on. And I heard a few years ago, I heard from a former state finance commissioner, a top finance official in the state, former Wells Fargo vice president, who was telling a story about his father. He said he was a graduate of a high school in North Minneapolis. He played saxophone in the school band it was a very poor family, 10 kids, and they didn't have a lot of money. They used school instruments. They received lessons provided by the school. They actually had band uniforms provided by the school. And he said at the end, and that was during the Great Depression. Think about that for a minute. I mean, I wasn't around then, I don't know, but it was 1936. His dad graduated from high school and he had been in the band. They couldn't afford an instrument, but he had a saxophone and so on provided by the school. I keep thinking, you know, if we have political will and so on, if we could do that kind of thing during the Depression, maybe we could do some things here about housing and other things. And the American Dream, which the UN reporter talked about, how the American Dream is disappearing for many. Until recently, we had the expectation, American Dream, my summary of it, and everybody has their own definition, I tried to Google what the American Dream was and get a lot of philosophical comments, but I always thought it was kind of that our kids are going to have things better than we had. Not necessarily materially, but they were going to have more options in life, more chance for education, more chance to improve themselves. They'd have better opportunities than we have. And now, I keep thinking, I went to St. Olaf, I graduated 40 years ago. And my tuition my first year was $3,600. And I keep thinking, I hate to know what it is now. It's in the 20 times that kind of category. Class sizes have grown in many schools in recent decades. Universal health care is not really considered a reasonable response. We can't possibly afford that. Again, I'll get into that tomorrow. Decent housing, until the 1980s, we had homeless shelters, but the only people in them were people who were chronically, mentally ill, chemically dependent, people we might call street people. Dorothy Day Center in Minnesota, a lot of programs like that. There were homeless people, but not many. You didn't have kids and families in homeless shelters. You didn't have people down on their luck. It tended to be individuals who were very sick. In the early 1980s, the federal government said, we're not going to be responsible for affordable housing. We'll keep doing some of what we're doing, but we're cutting way back. And I still remember in the early 80s when some churches started opening up homeless shelters, and now we've come to the point where we expect homeless shelters to be there. We're doing all this at a time when some people have an expectation of more and more and more for themselves, and that's the way the market goes. We're able to do that. We're now at the stage when we have three people having as much wealth as the bottom half. That wouldn't have happened 50 years ago. I mean, partly because the economy is such that one quick invention, the speed of new developments and so on, is such that Jeff Bezos can invent a software program and be one of the richest people in the world in a few years. But the other thing was, until the Kennedy administration, all through the 50s and so on, the top federal income tax bracket, which had plenty of exclusions and so on, but it was 91%. Now the top bracket's 35, I can't remember what it is after the recent tax bill. But taxes have gone down for them. Our taxes tend to be more regressive than they were 50 years ago. And we invest things that aren't helping the bottom end of people. And I'm not making the argument that we're equality. Steve had a session yesterday on economics and inequality. And there's some of the discussion was, well, can we, should we eliminate inequality? I'm not sure if we could. I'm not arguing we should. I'm arguing there should be a floor that nobody should be beneath. And I think a lot of people would like to have that. I think it's a vision for our future would be that we have a society where the richest country on the planet at least provides basic necessities for people. And that is something that we as a nation signed our name to in 1948, I think it is, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt and Harold Sass and some other Americans were heavily involved in, but it was signed by virtually all the nations of the world. So it's a beautiful document if you've never read it. Among the things it says that all people, we want to ensure all people are provided those things that protect human dignity and make for healthy life, adequate food and shelter, meaningful work, safe communities, healthcare, and education. And it's a 20-page, 15-page document that spells out what I think most of us would say are what we, people of faith, want, believe others should have this. Most caring people think, if we have the ability to do so in a society, we ought to make sure nobody's left behind like that. I would argue that those are doable things. In most of ancient human civilizations and long ago human civilizations, you didn't really have the ability to eliminate poverty. And I don't think Christ's statement, the poor you will always have with you, was meant to be a prediction of the way things should be. It was meant to say, talk about what priorities, about whether this woman who was being generous was doing the right thing. But in terms of attempts to eliminate poverty, we made a number of attempts in this country. In the 1930s, the New Deal, the time we probably most had the desperate situation. People came in and decided, we as a nation decide we're going to take steps forward. Not all of them were the perfect ideas, but we made huge progress in addressing the one-third of a nation that was ill-housed, ill-clothed, ill-fed, and we did it in a bold way. I keep saying that if people who have progressive ideas and the idea of building a better future today. We're live in the 1930s. We probably have tried a pilot program for Social Security because obviously in the Depression, we want to take care of seniors, but we don't have the money to take care of everyone. We only try a few hundred people per state. But no, they, in the 1930s, at the depths of the Depression, they invested in seniors, they invested in rural electrification, they invested in building infrastructure for the country, and it was a bold attempt to try and eliminate or to reduce poverty. In the 1960s, we had a war on poverty, which the best way to describe it was one we surrendered in. We didn't fight the war, we did it for a couple of years, and then now politics and attitudes changed, and elected officials changed, and so we gave up or surrendered on that. And so for the last 30 or 40 years, we've been sliding backwards. I suggest that you look at any economic analysis of what's happening. One of the biggest changes that should help low-income struggling people is the addition of more women in the workforce. In the 1950s and 60s, the typical Leave It to Beaver family, one parent worked, the other one was working at home. But we've since that time switched to where we now have two parents in most cases working, many of them working two jobs and still struggling to make ends meet. And I keep thinking sometimes people say, well, the solution is get more education. You know, if you can't make enough money on a microeconomic level, that makes sense. If you're not making it, if you can afford to get, you have the time and the ability to get more education or training, you're going to get higher pay. It does work on a microeconomic level. On a societal-wide level, it doesn't work. And if every person in the country got a four-year college degree, if everybody got a professional degree, a PhD, whatever level you want, there's still going to be people who are cleaning motel rooms, who are doing service jobs, who are doing jobs that aren't going to pay a living wage. So the education alone won't do it, and so we have to find a way to try and step forward and address it. But we, despite the addition of another almost 50% into the workforce, despite the fact that there was a relatively small percentage of women working outside of the home at the time, and now we have much more workers, we still have more and more people who are working and working poor. So who's filled the gap? How have we filled the gap during these last 40 years? Well, it's been largely churches and nonprofits. Homeless shelters, soup kitchens, food shelves. And it's not that the churches are, hey, we think this is the best way to go with it. Back in the 1980s, Reagan administration said churches ought to step up and address it. We're going to cut welfare. Churches can do it. Why, if each church would just take on some low-income people, and it's kind of complicated because how does a church? And they said the average congregation at the time would have had to take on something like 8 or 10 families in order to do that. I keep thinking that might be good in a mega church, but a small church in South Dakota, I'm not sure they could handle that. And how you help them? What are you doing? You're helping bring over food. How about helping them get a job that has a decent wage? How are you going to do that? It wouldn't work necessarily, but the churches and nonprofits definitely try. A few years ago, we had a commission on poverty, which I'll get into in a minute, but one of the advocates at that point, when we were talking about food shelves and soup kitchens and so on, one of the advocates from the churches was asking the good question, because one of the members on the commission said, well, yeah, how can we get more food shelves going? And this person who was heavily involved working in food shelves, I mean, volunteering on a weekly basis in a local food shelf, said, you know, his question was, why do we have to have an alternative set of free grocery stores for people who can't afford the regular? Why do we have to have more church basements and homeless shelters instead of real housing for people that they can afford? And I think the people who are doing the direct work and filling the holes and trying to plug the gaps are saying, why do we have to have it this way? And so in Minnesota, faith community advocacy started speaking out and saying, we got to do something. And this is about 2006 or so. And they said, we want a commission on ending poverty. And they were church people who don't want to be unreasonable or anything, so they set a goal and they asked the state to create a commission. And usually commissions, they have a title and then they have an explanation what their mission is. This one, the mission was spelled out in the title, was Legislative Commission on Ending Poverty in Minnesota by the Year 2020. Pretty precise, you don't need the explanation, that's what the task of it was to do. And when we were having a debate in our caucus about this the last week of the legislative session that year, we talked about this. It was in the Senate bill, but not in the House bill, and the Senate author of it was saying, I really hope you guys will fight for keeping this in there. It was $500,000 and $250,000 to fund this commission, and that would really be helpful in commission ending poverty by 2020. And then after we were done, talk about that for a minute, no comments. He just spoke about why we should fight for it. Then we got back to what was the topic of the year, which was a public funding for a baseball stadium for the Minnesota Twins. It was unpopular to the public, but we gotta get this done. It's really urgent and so on. And after they were talking about for a few minutes, I raised my hand and majority leader called on me and I said, you know, I'm wondering if we could put the Twins owner on the 2020 plan and address poverty now. Because it really struck me as, you know, what are our priorities? Even in pushing for studying this, we'll put in a dozen years extra and so on to do it. And I understand you can't change something overnight anyway, but we created this commission, and I don't choose to serve on a lot of these. I've served on a lot of commissions, and they put really nice reports out, and then they get put away on library shelves and ignored. But I was actually getting pressure from some of the folks in the faith community, oh, you gotta serve on this commission. So I agreed to do so and ended up serving as a co-chair of it. And after a few meetings, it seemed that the attitude was, well, you know, we'd like to make things a little bit better and so on, and we can't really eliminate poverty and so on. And the expectation of many of the committee members, it was a bipartisan thing. There were 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans. It was evenly split between the houses. And of these folks, I think a lot of them were, the goal was to make poverty less severe. All their proposals and everything else was maybe we can get a few more homeless shelters in these communities where we need more. And I, one of the meetings I asked, you know, he said, that's not our mission. Our mission is Commission on Ending Poverty by 2020. I said, I don't think any of you would be willing to serve on a commission who had the title of what you're trying to do, namely a legislative commission on trying to make poverty a little less miserable for some of the people in it by the year 2020, which is basically what the political thinking was. Well, you know, we can't really do this, so we could do a little bit of tinkering here. But if you put a name on that, if you name something, it's kind of, really, you'll serve on a commission to make poverty a little less miserable for some of the people in it by 15 years from now, 12 years from now. Anyway, it was a valuable commission. We did poverty tours around the state. We were trying to get every member of the commission to go on at least two or three, but there were about eight of them. I went on about half of them. And it had powerful stories. And I remember in southwestern Minnesota, one of my colleagues who, really nice guy, and he knew his district well, he felt, and so on. And I remember driving from one stop in his district to another with the tour, and some of the non-members of the commission legislators, the local districts, we'd always invite them to participate. And one woman who spoke at it, she was early 30s, and she was saying how she's really looking hard to find somebody who will pull her teeth. She was already missing three or four teeth. She said, I can't afford a dentist, and I just want a dentist who will pull my teeth. And she said, you know, I feel it's kind of shameful to me because I'm only 30 years old and losing my teeth. But that's the way it is. And I keep thinking, what kind of a place are we? And I was talking to my colleague. He gave me a ride to the next stop instead of going with the van. And in it, he was saying, I know her parents. I didn't know that. And he was surprised to see this. And some of the basement apartments that people are living in, these are farm communities and unsafe, I mean, taking a tour of some apartments and so on. It was unsafe, terrible situation. I think he was shocked because our communities don't have poor people. That's what they have in the core cities. They don't have that in small town Minnesota. And so it was very educational for them. One of the ones that I really got was, you know, how food stamps are only allowed to be used for buying certain approved products. We had one woman who was struggling. She had a drug conviction when she was like 19 years old. She was now 30 or so. She said, I can never get a job. A job that pays any decent wage. I can't find housing I feel is safe enough to live in, but I do with what I get. But she said when she's buying, she often would buy food with food stamps, find somebody standing out the store, outside of the store, who was going in and say, I'll buy some groceries and then I'll trade them with you in exchange for feminine hygiene products, because feminine hygiene products were covered. And I think, you know, think of what the person's dignity does when they're going in and buying groceries to trade with another shopper so they can trade for some tampons or whatever. I mean, it's just a bizarre situation. We heard incredible stories. One woman who I've gotten to know over the years, kind of woman, if you ever call somebody a saint, she would be it. She lives in northern Minnesota, maybe Indian descent, I'm not sure, but she and her husband have taken in like 20, 30 special needs kids. They've adopted about 10 of them. They're all struggling. These are kids who have severe developmental or other disabilities. And she said she tries to give them a good life. And she says as they get closer to 18 and start, she has to start helping them move out on their own. She says, I try to teach these kids to be happy being poor because that's all they'll ever know. I thought that's a real, I mean, I'm not going to call that a defeatist attitude for her because she's the kind of person who's doing everything in her power, but she's recognizing what the reality for these kids is. So we had a commission, we had an interesting tour of things, we had bipartisan concern. I think everybody on the commission wanted to do something. We got to do something. This is really sad. I don't know if we could have had much bipartisan consensus on, okay, we should pass this legislation and do this and so on. So we talked about the themes, mapping the route. I suggested we were trying to map out what we need to do to address poverty. And it worked. People were able to, even if they didn't want to take the route, our job is to map out how you would end poverty if you were to put the commitment in to do this. And we put together a report, I don't know, 40, 50 page report that I think was very valuable. And we gave it a dozen years to make it happen, and no surprise, it got put on a shelf, and we've done virtually nothing, and we're not the year 2020 yet, but we raised the minimum wage, which is one thing we ought to do, and so on, but basically, we didn't succeed. So quickly, before I want to open this up for discussion, I didn't realize it was that late, factors we have to address, certainly, simplest way to address poverty is make sure people get enough pay, pay or other wages or other ways of meeting expenses. You don't have to buy groceries at a free place if you can afford them yourself. Tax credits, earned income tax credits, been popular in a bipartisan way. There are ways of lowering expenses, which is one thing there was strong bipartisan agreement on, and that is that the financial literacy is sorely lacking in people. The only time we've been able to stop predatory lenders was with the earned income tax credit, which low-income people get. These tax preparers would come in and they give you tax anticipation loans. They fill out your taxes, they give you a tax anticipation loan at 40, 50% interest, and then you get your tax refund because of the earned income tax credit, and they take half of it away. And that's our efforts to try and address poverty, and people are thinking, that's outrageous. So we actually banned them from making that kind of loans. But financial literacy and knowing how to be frugal with things is something people, if you've never been taught it, if you don't know anything about interest rates and how credit cards are a lousy way to finance things. Trying to do that, there are a number of things. The challenges are great. The chemical dependency, mental health, education needs, lack of social support. There was a lot of agreement among the commission that these things are things we have to address. These are challenges, but as I mentioned, the UN report said earlier, the American dream is becoming an American illusion, I think is the way they framed it. It's something that you can hope to address, but you're not really going to get there because we have less social mobility. We have people falling into poverty, a few people getting out of poverty, but most people are going to be there for multiple generations. And before opening up for discussion, I was going to say one bill that I've introduced several times in recent years, which summarizes some of the things I think we ought to do, and it seems, oh, that's a dream bill, one of the advocates said. I said, no, that's not a dream bill. This is not a bill that's going to make everybody really comfortable or anything. But it was trying to pull people out of poverty, and how would we do it? It was going to be a phase in over several years to a significantly higher minimum wage, My bill would be $15 an hour over about 4 or 5 years, which would be, you couldn't do it overnight. That would be a huge shock to the economy. Small towns, you just couldn't do that. But on the other hand, we have to slowly be making those changes. That drives up the prices of things. Hamburgers, McDonald's would be more expensive if they have to pay people more. But reality is that you've got to, if you don't have a floor under people, you're going to have people earning far less. Another phase of it was we have a sliding fee child care program for affordable child care for people. Grossly underfunded, so they're waiting lists. You're on welfare, you get a job, and hey, I'll come into work as soon as I can find child care. How long would that be? Well, there's a 2-year waiting list. And the program is sorely underfunded and so on, but making that happen. Increasing our earned income tax credit, which is government giving tax refunds to people that exceed their tax liability. The federal government does that, the state has some, and was going to increase welfare benefits. Our welfare benefits for a parent with a single child, for any family, have not gone up in 30 years. Over 30 years, not a penny of an increase. And so mine was a proposal to do that. We were going to fund it by closing the tax loophole on high-income individuals and so on. It's a very doable thing. You have to fund this because even if you're just simply a minimum wage increase, state of Minnesota, we're the ones who set nursing home rates and therefore effectively set the rates nursing home aides get paid, LPNs and others who work in nursing homes. We basically set their wages because of our payment and what the payment rates are for nursing homes, and a lot of them aren't making anywhere near $15 an hour. They're making $10-$11 an hour. Personal care attendants for people with disabilities make that kind of wages. Even people who have higher education, 4-year degrees, who do that kind of work get paid far below the living wage. So I'd argue if we had the political will, we could make that happen, and we could address and finally address what we said in the 1940s was a right of every human being, the right to a decent income, to safe housing, to basically meet people's needs. So I'd argue we can do that if we have the political will to do that, but I didn't mean to go on quite that long. I wanted to have more discussion about things that, well, you can't do that, why can't you do that, or what you'd add, and maybe thinking about the role of faith communities, role of individuals, and the role of our political system. So with that, I'll open it up for discussion or criticism or comments or whatever. Anybody you want to start?
How do you speak to your colleagues that listen to 49 testimonies about working for health benefits? I mean, how do you finally, is there any hope in that conversation?
I always hope so. And one of the author of the bill is a first term senator from Northwestern Minnesota, and he had several people, and that's a 5-hour, 6-hour drive, and they had a couple of people from a series of mental health clinics up there who was driving down saying, we're gonna shut our doors with this. Mm-hmm. Because their funding, they get a couple of grants from the counties and so on, but a lot of their funding comes from their Medicaid recipients who come in and need help. He says, these folks aren't gonna be able to work, we're gonna shut our doors. And he was, yeah, we're going to have to take a look at that. That was his response to that. And the one I hit, though, after the end, because, again, there's still, it's clear we're marching forward with this legislation. And I was thrilled that, in the end, it got set aside and didn't go anywhere. But that day, I quoted the guy who was still sitting at the end of the 2.5-hour meeting, was sitting in our authors of the bills and their witnesses have a table, like in Congress, and the audience is behind them. And this one speaker was sitting about 3 rows behind him, just sitting all by himself. And I asked him, you know, you guys are really big on taking care of veterans. And this guy, what would you tell him? He said, well, we'll take a look at it. That was about all he would respond. But I do think that those things have to hit somebody in the gut a little bit. I have to hope that happens, and I think it does, because I'd say even the most generous person has some selfish instincts in them, and even the most selfish person has generous instincts in them as well. So, yeah. I really do believe people have capacity to change, and not by yelling at them. That's not going to get us anywhere. But other comments or questions or thoughts or objections? Or yes?
Well, thank you for the work that you do, because I think it must be a lonely place sometimes, because of that whole expectation set. But I was struck, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book Evicted, and that took place just a few miles from where we live in a very affluent community. And the whole question of housing and poverty, the author makes a really persuasive argument that housing is also a key to addressing the whole poverty issue. I wonder if you have any comments
on housing. I was telling some of my colleagues, I think Minnesota should learn from the great progressive state Utah, because Utah was the first state that said, we think it's smarter, instead of waiting until somebody's been through chemical dependency treatment and everything else, housing first. We want to get somebody in housing first, because I would hope, and I think some of it might be the Mormon Church's influence on saying we are our brother's keepers and so on, but also just pure economics that they calculated the amount of time you spend on for a homeless person, for police calls, for detox, for other programs and services is a lot more per month than just finding them cheap housing. So Utah was saying their goal was, and they haven't, I think their goal was to have it by about this year, and they had largely addressed it for veterans, but they weren't anywhere close to getting it done. But housing in many cases, well, you don't qualify, we're not going to help you with housing until you beat all your other things like addiction and everything else, when of course being homeless is a really strong driver. Somebody struggling with any form of addiction, when you're in pain, you know, drugs may relieve your pain, your emotional pain, your depression, everything else. So trying to fix the person before we give them the opportunity to get fixed, yeah, I'd say housing is one of the key things. And since the federal government backed away from its commitment to try and housing everyone, the Section 8 program, which some of you may be familiar with, that's been around since the 60s, but since it was basically supposed to be covering people struggling for that, now it's kind of, well, you may qualify for it every time there's an opening in the waiting line. Every few years there's an opening and it's filled up within a few minutes, and there are long waiting lines to get on the waiting line. And even if you do, there aren't housing units that will accept the Section 8 vouchers anymore because of changes in federal law. Housing's a key issue, yeah.
What insights do you have for why the electorate of 1948 would make such a compelling statement about what we owe, sort of the basic needs? And where we are now.
I would say it wasn't the electorate who did that. I would hope the electorate felt supported that. I think after World War II, I think there was a lot of people, we beat this injustice, we're going to keep working to address injustice.
It's just Illinois?
Earlier in Steve's session on environment today, we were talking about governments, what about damage? If Bangladesh is choosing to accept polluting plants to create jobs and so on, is that something that people of Bangladesh support or not? Well, I care to bet that most decisions by most governments around the world aren't things that are popularly supported. I would hope that it was supported in 1948. I think most people, most Americans of both parties, really do want to take care of people. But when you're told that these folks are lazy bums and they don't want to do anything and therefore you should do this, when you're clueless about the UN reporter saying how his sense is a lot of these politicians saying these things have never been in a low-income person's home, they don't recognize the reality. I really think that's one of the things I liked about our poverty tour. It was face-to-face. You had to see it. You couldn't pretend it was somewhere else. And I think that's what's really helpful, and I think the electorate is the same way. I think at the time that report finished, one of the Democratic legislative leaders who was campaigning for governor at the time was told the woman was an ELCA clergy woman who was running this Minnesota Without Poverty organization advocacy group in each order, Nancy, your job is simply to build the political will to ending poverty, and we're going to make it happen. And I told him, that's a sucker deal for you. All you have to do is build the political support to make doing the right thing popular, and then we'll do it. Why don't, is it our job to try and do it even if it's unpopular? And I also told her that it doesn't work that way, because I could guarantee her in 2008, I think that was, I could guarantee to her that a majority of Minnesotans would say, we want to take care of people who are hurting. We do. We want to increase help for those who are disabled. We want to increase help for those who are mentally ill. We want to help those who are unemployed. We want to help poor kids. We want to help all these folks. Overwhelmingly, public supports that. On the other hand, you could work for 20 years to build that support even stronger, and there still be all it is one TV ad or something saying about welfare cheats, and everybody says, we want to cut welfare, because at the same time they want to help people, they want to cut welfare because there's disconnect because of what they were taught. And I think that's a really strong thing, is you can't get there that way. There's public strongly supports helping people, they strongly oppose welfare, and it's a disconnect based on, I'd argue, some disinformation and stereotyping and people who are hyping that. So,
yes? I have a couple of things. One of them is, I think it's the difference between what's considered the worthy poor and the unworthy poor. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to put the people in that unworthy poor bucket, the lazy, whatever. And you hear we want to help people who have a genuine need.
Right.
And how do you define the genuine need? And the second thing I would point out is, I don't know if you've read the book, Toxic Charity. It's quite good. It talks about places where you say, you go to this village in Mexico and you send a crew from your church and you want to paint their church. And then you hear that, well, they've had 6 crews already this year painting the church. Meanwhile, the local painters are standing outside wondering, how come we can't get this work? Mm-hmm. So you come in and do the labor and you take jobs away from the local people. And in the end, you give them something that they don't need. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work.
Real quickly on both of those. The second one, yes, there are times when our charity, our foreign aid and so on have been things that have been harmful. We want to market our farm goods to a country that has a good economic system for farmers. They're subsistence farmer, not they're above subsistence farmer, but they are living off of it. And we replace it with our stuff, which is for our interest, and we call it foreign aid. That's a good point. And your other point about the truly needy during versus the less deserving needy. Yeah, I think that started in about the 1980s. Well, we want to help the truly needy people. And so that means if somebody is starving, you're going to give them a meal tonight. If somebody's trying to get out of poverty and start building their way up, yeah, they're not truly needy. They're not starving tonight, so we're going to... You try and do that, you're trapping people in poverty, and in a lot of our programs, asset limits and so on. Well, you can qualify for this if you have a car that's worth less than $2,000, and you or I might be able to make a car that's worth $2,000 or so work and know what needs to be taken care of, but there are a lot of people that means it's a car that doesn't work. How are they going to work that? So yeah, it's a trap to say we're going to take care of the truly needy, but not those who aren't truly needy. I mean, I don't think our welfare programs at their height, they had plenty of flaws in the way they were designed and so on, but I don't think at their height they were what you'd call generous. And that somebody who was not needy was whatever. Anything else? We have 5 more minutes.
How about the impact of cost shifting in all these programs? This is primarily medicine as an example, but also in housing or in nutrition. So you develop a political program legislated by the government to provide services to some subsegment of the society, but you underfund it at the government level. And then the only...
Somebody else has to fill the gap.
The only recourse for the provider is to shift up the cost of those who aren't on the program to gain enough revenue so they can fund the shortfall in revenue to cover the...
Right, that's a huge flaw in a lot of things. My healthcare program, which we'll be talking about tomorrow, one of the legal requirements for the thing is it has to pay fair and reasonable negotiated rates, because the Medicaid program is in most states underfunds things. In Minnesota, it sorely underfunds dental care to the point you can't find dentists willing to cover. And if you were expanding something to more people, you can't run a medical system if you're not paying people decent rates. And government has sometimes done that. The other area of cost shifting in healthcare, just for healthcare for a minute, is right now, lots of people, the more people who can't afford healthcare, where they don't pay their bills and the hospitals overcharge others to make up for it. And so we are, people who are uninsured when they go to the emergency room, which is where they go because it's always open and they know it and it's whatever and they have to care for them, that's shifted to everybody else. So cost shifting by government or by people who aren't covered with things is a huge problem, and it makes the economy less fair for everyone else. And it's not free. I mean, if I'm not covered for health care and I get a heart attack and I go in, the bill is being paid, just not by me, and so somebody else ends up paying more for it.
But the impact of cost shifting is every time there's a cost shift,
it makes
a new segment of the population becomes right. Unable to.
Which is why that's something you've got to work to prevent, because many times when I was saying some poorly designed programs over the years, that's a huge issue, and I think it's worth it. Steve.
Yeah, I hope this is an unfair question, but the proposal that you laid out in your talk, the things were sort of incremental. And I don't mean that as a right. criticism. I think, you know, given your need to compromise and right. politics and everything, it's fairly ambitious. But if we could make you dictator for 3 days or something, are there big audacious ideas flowing around out there that you would
actually in that bill, other than the minimum wage, which I don't think you could do immediately, would be one that was designed. It would be tripling our state earned income tax credit. It would be fully funding our sliding fee child care program, be increasing welfare. But it was only the minimum wage, because I would argue that, you know, we can't make some of the changes. I mean, you can't shock the economy in such a way. If you're working on a small business and you're struggling to get your own compensation and so on, and you got a profit margin of 3 or 4% or something, and then you're going to raise their costs by what would be 7-8%. I mean, they're not able to take the shock of it. And so I would say that some of those things are ones we ought to do. I'd say a fair tax code would make sense. Why is earned income taxed at higher rates than capital gains? Well, because capital gains are the three wealthiest Americans, the 10 wealthiest or the 2,000 or the 10,000 wealthiest Americans, their income is not earned income, and it's capital gains and so on. And our tax system is a very regressive one. Minnesota, they often talk about how Minnesota, people who would disagree with me say, Minnesota already has the most progressive tax code of any state in the country. And I said, that's false. That's absolutely false. We're the least regressive tax code of anybody in the country. Because the lowest income Minnesotans pay a higher percentage of their income in state and local taxes. When you count property taxes, sales taxes, licensing fees, and other things like that. The low income folks pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than people who earn 10,000 times as much as they do. And so, yeah, I would have a fairer tax code. What I call fair, meaning a progressive one. And that, in my mind, you know, I think it's perfectly appropriate that Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or all those folks, that they come up with great ideas, they should be well compensated for. But, you know, if you had 91% federal tax code, they wouldn't be tens of billionaires. They might be a billionaire. The wealthiest people in the country might be. And to their credit, I'm not trying to vilify them. I think Warren Buffett certainly and Bill Gates have pledged to give away most of their fortune when they die or even before they die. You know, Bill Gates, I think he plans to leave his kids only a few billion dollars, which is literally, I'm saying it in a humorous way, but literally he's given away most of his wealth. He's $90 billion. So, but there are some things I argue, if I could just write the law to do it, and that's not a good way to run a democracy, so I'm not advocating for that. But if you could do that, yeah, some of the things you can't do immediately, and I'd say minimum wage is one, a slow and steady thing, you can make that kind of changes because it is a shift in the economy. You can make certain goods and services go up in cost, and you're going to be paying people more, which more than makes up for it. And can get into the debates about minimum wage. I do like the one illustration, though, that when Washington State raised its minimum wage significantly more, significantly above Idaho and so on, that Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, that there was concern that all the people are going to, everybody's going to, all the fast food joints in Spokane will close, people will go over to Coeur d'Alene and so on, and other suburban Idaho communities, and because they'd be able to do it. And actually, business did go up in Washington, and if anything, Idaho businesses were having trouble getting workers who could work at several dollars an hour less. But the evidence, clearly people say, well, if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to have fewer jobs for people there. And I think the fewer jobs, that is true to a certain extent, but it's to the other extent that it actually creates more of a market. Is somebody in, you were one of the people responding to yesterday, was talking about how, you know, the whole idea, if we raise taxes on the wealthy, they won't have any incentive to work. And I'm thinking, you know, if I'm used to a $1 million a year for spending on things I want to spend on, and somehow you tax me more, and I don't have $1 million a year anymore, the incentive might be for me to work harder rather than the other way around. But some things can be done overnight and some cannot. But anyway, I think we are out of time. I'll be around and glad to talk with people. I've got a talk on healthcare tomorrow, and I appreciate your attendance. Thank you.